Hello and welcome to Skeleton Songs.
You don't think people think this is a music podcast, do you?
And what, because they sing it?
Yeah.
I'm actually quite a good singer.
Well, would you like to do your part in there?
No, I just want people to know that I'm good and not have to prove it.
She is good. And she can play the guitar.
I can. And the trombone, which actually is my best instrument. I'm not joking. It sounds like I'm making this up. I'm not. Which is quite embarrassing, really, because, you know, I'm quite a long, gangly person. I'm quite sort of tall and etiolated. And that's not really... Playing the trombone didn't help when I was a gawky 16-year-old girl with my image of being a blossoming, beautiful woman. I'll tell you that.
Listeners, if you ever meet Lottie and want to troll her, I found a very effective strategy is to listen to a piece of music that has a trombone playing in it and to say, ooh, I like the trumpet there.
Although, top tip, ignore him because he doesn't know anything about anything. But trombones are actually beautiful instruments, even though like most people find them funny. But come on, let's be clear, the tuba is funny. No. The trombone is actually beautiful in all types of music. But Rimsky-Korsakov is where it's at for the trombone if you want classical. Otherwise, obviously, it's jazz. And I'll tell you this for free as well. The brass section is where you want to be in an orchestra. We are the fun ones. We're the last in and the first out, and we're really chill. It's the first violins and the first flutes that are not so fun. They are very keen, whereas the brass section is like, hey.
So one, I like the way you talk about it. Two, it has turned into a music podcast.
Yes, okay, we got distracted. Now we're turning it magically back to magic by the power of talking about something new.
Only in silence the word, only in darkness the light, only in dying life, bright the hawk's flight on the empty sky.
It's so beautiful.
You might have recognised that as the epigraph which opens... which opens A Wizard of Ursi, Le Guin. And I didn't know anything about Taoism when I read that at the age of 7, I think. But when I came to Taoist concepts later, the debt is obvious. And of course, Le Guin acknowledged it, talked about it, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Who's Ursula Le Guin? Who was Ursula Le Guin?
She was great.
She was great. She's such a goddamn loss.
Life well lived, right? Everyone has to go, and I can't think of a more impressive legacy that she has left. I mean, she's considered, correct me if I'm wrong here, like sort of the grand scion of American science fiction in a way that has just pushed the boundaries of the genre, and she's touched the lives of millions and millions of people.
You're absolutely right. Although when I was reading about her, one of the things I came across is that she preferred to be thought of as an American writer rather than an American science fiction writer.
I can see why.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about poor old Stephen King, who's desperate to not be called a genre writer and wants to be taken just generally as an author. And obviously he is, I think, one of the most successful modern writers ever to have lived ever, so this is no shade on him at all. But there is something about genre fiction meeting the sort of literary establishment where sort of the majority of the world seems reluctant to not mention somebody has a science fiction affiliation.
And I think more than that, she had written an outside the science fiction ghetto very successfully. Mm. And she, I have the sense, now I'm speaking beyond what I've read, but I have the sense that part of the reason she wanted to be thought of as an American writer rather than an American science fiction writer was that she was of the school that thought science fiction was a literature of ideas and not just a graveyard genre for cheap thrills.
Mm.
So that was part of her reaction.
Well, if she's looking down at us, I can tell you that when I first read Wizard of Earthsea when I was smaller, she was not presented to me as a science fiction writer. It was just, this is a really good book, read it. It wasn't, this is great sci-fi, which even things like, you know, Tolkien struggled to escape the grasp of the genre. So I think she has achieved what she wanted to.
I think she has, and I think recently, it's like we've talked about off mic before, is that the final victory of science fiction and fantasy has also been its final defeat in some senses. For the longest time, it was a very unrespectable part of the fiction world and of publishing, and now, you know, post Game of Thrones, it's ubiquitous. But of course, as Theodore Sturgeon observed, 90%. So the story is Theodore Sturgeon, the science fiction writer, was told that 90% of science fiction is shit, and he said, "Well, 90% of everything is shit," which is, you know, Sturgeon's law, inaccurate. And this is the thing now. It is much harder to find unusual science fiction fantasy that doesn't fit than it used to be. Intelligent, I guess. Socially conscious, sure. Well written, yeah, you know, you have to look a bit, but it's not there. But it's there. But it's rare that I'll open a genre book these days and be surprised by what I find in it.
Mm.
There's lots of subgenres because it's now part of the culture. But why is she so... Go on.
Well, I was going to say, it's just before we leave that point, it's funny that when you talk about that, because that, I think, is a very similar situation to video games in general, that we are also a very specific genre. And as society gets more accepting, generally, of video game and video game culture, which, so it's become less niche than it was, you know, 20 years ago, there is a sense that some of the really innovative, interesting stuff that some top talents are making are branching out of traditional video game genre, leaving a more typified group of games behind it that would fit the more traditional, you know. Like, every time I meet anybody and I say I work in games, they're always like, oh, like Call of Duty, or like, oh, FIFA. And you know, great that those games are doing so well, but like, clearly what we do is like, it couldn't be further really from those games without not being a game anymore. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff pushing at the boundaries of what video games are. And I read an article the other day, which you will hate, actually, which was saying that the future of video games and the more interesting stuff is like transmedia, because we've got a lot of kind of overlap, like the Bandersnatch stuff that Netflix did that was an experiment. And I just think it's kind of a similar situation as genre fiction. It's now become part of wider media culture, but wider screen culture. And it's increasingly going that way.
Years ago, in the 90s, I read an essay by... Greg Kostikian, I think it was I Have No Words But I Must Design, which was a seminal.
Why would you remind me of that story?
Because Greg Kostikian did, because he hates you.
Thanks, Greg.
It was a seminal and great piece on game design in a very early journal. And one of the things I think he said was, people say the future of entertainment is interactive. It's like saying the future of entertainment is finagle wits. A light switch is interactive. You press it goes off. And it's true. I think there was a time when I heard the word transmedia and didn't want to give myself a friction burn. Because generally...
this is a podcast of opinions.
So I'm not saying things that are transmedia are bad. I'm saying that things that primarily identify themselves as transmedia... That means their transmedia is the most interesting thing about them, and that's not innately interesting.
This is the antithesis of the Coen brothers quote that we always talked about each other.
Go on.
You want to say it? The one about follow the art.
I can't remember the exact quote. So.
Well, we failed you, listeners. But the general sense of the Coen brothers, who of course are brilliant filmmakers, was that the best advice they can give other artists and what they do in their own work is they start off with a creative idea and then they follow that idea whatever direction it leads. So presumably, if the idea really lent itself to a transmedia project, I guess that's where they would go.
Mm.
But they say that the point of the art and how the creation process happens is the most important thing. You shouldn't be thinking about, you know, the extra stuff that sometimes you're told to think about, like in games, classic, like a bit of advice for early devs is like, start marketing before you actually start designing, to start thinking about how you can make it hooky and how you can make streamers want to play it and all this stuff. And that is good advice in terms of marketability, but that does rather rub up against, you know, if you think about games as art, then I don't imagine Michelangelo was sitting there thinking, how can I make my beautiful sculpture a bit more...
I think he probably was. I think you know, we're both in favour of art with a capital A. But I think you sometimes give artists, by which I include writers, too much credit. I think Michelangelo is probably sitting there thinking, if I make my Michelangelo look a little bit more like that bloke I think the Pope fancies, then I'll probably get more work.
I was going to say, if I know artists, he was sitting there thinking, oh, why doesn't Julia look at me? Oh, she's got such nice hair. Right, sorry, we got distracted. We were talking back to
Le Guin.
Why wonderful so Le Guin. I don't. Well, you tell me. You're the writer. I mean, so
you're the literary.
The literary critic is true. Okay. Well, in terms of her magic system,
and just a reminder, if anybody has inexplicably tuned into this first podcast for the first time, the last four or five episodes we've done have been about magic in fiction. And we've talked about Shakespeare with the Tempest. We talked about Faustus. We talked about Jack Vance and its influence in D&D. We talked about who's that woman who wrote about those blokes?
Suzanne Clark.
Yeah, because I always get her surname wrong, inexplicably. Suzanne Clark. Susanna Clark. And
I always get her forename wrong. Together, we nearly make a real person.
I don't think we did an episode on Tolkien, did we? Because he's so present in everything we talk about.
We just mention him all the time, yeah. He just lives with us.
So we're going to round it off, and we're going to end with Le Guin, who is, you know, for my money, the best fiction novel of the 20th century written with magic foregrounded is A Wizard of Earthsea. And I think it's better than Jonathan Strange's Mr. Norrell. But it's a bit like saying coffee is better than tea. I mean, it is, but it's kind of a silly opinion.
That's the thing. I mean, I think if what you're saying by best is which one were you going to take with you on a desert island, yeah, then I agree. I think there is something just profoundly wonderful. And I would go so far as nearly to say sublime about Wizard of Earthsea. And I wonder if part of that comes from the simplicity, because, of course, Le Guin was writing it relatively early in her career, explicitly for young adults or late teenagers, sort of. So she was specifically trying to make it approachable, which is why there are themes of, you know, the building's roman and learning about yourself and growing up and all this stuff inherent in it, because she wanted to make it, you know, relevant for the readers she was writing for. Whereas, of course, Suzanne Clark was writing for adults. And to be clear, this doesn't mean that Wizard of Earthsea is a sort of baby book for babies at all. There's a hell of a lot in it, and I think people of all ages can appreciate it, which is part of its majesty. But in terms of the world that she creates, and of course there are sequels to The Wizard of Earthsea, but this is the opening one and the one that is closest to most people's hearts that I've spoken to, and certainly mine, it really feels natural and believable. You know, a lot of fantasy novels are brilliant in many ways, but I don't really read them and think, oh, I can imagine myself totally in that world and I understand how the plumbing works and I know what the voting rights are and it's just like where I live, except, you know, different. And that isn't necessarily a criticism, but it is really amazing how she manages to create a world which feels so old and so layered. We often talk about patina when we're making our own games and how you get, it's very difficult to create the sense of centuries of people and cultures overlapping and building up over time, which you get in reality. But she manages to do it. And magic is sort of woven into the foundations of this very natural, organic world in a way that I can't think of happening elsewhere. I mean, even Tolkien, to use him as a sort of counterpoint, it does feel like, obviously, it's a believable world, but it does feel like there are the sort of bad people over there and the dark forces that sort of influence the world, and then the sort of goodies are over here. I mean, that's a vast simplification, so please forgive me, Tolkien. And Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, you know, it's a very stylized story, deliberately so. It's obviously specifically trying to do something like a historical novel and read like a historical novel, so it does come across as a little bit more distance. But Wizard of Earthsea feels like Le Guin has just opened a window on the train carriage into a totally different land, but it's believable. It's just, you know, it could be Canada, except it's magic.
So I'm really glad he said all that, but
I disagree with all of it.
No, I don't. Let's talk in a minute about her family background, which is, I think, really fundamental to the sense of groundedness and patina and layers. But you reminded me, of course, that it is a novel written for children and young adults. So a couple of things about that. First of all, just some dates to focus our minds. Do you happen to know either when Le Guin was born or how old she was when she wrote Wizard? I had looked both these things up.
So I know that, well, I think The Wizard of Earthsea was written in the early 60s.
Late 60s. Late 60s. 1968,
okay, fine. And I'm going to guess that she was born in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Was she? 1920s.
Yeah. 1929. So again, Le Guin was born around about the time Celtic Simulator is set. She was born around the time.
Why don't we have a Le Guin stand-in in Cultus? An absolutely missed opportunity.
Because she'd have been there.
Well,
but the point is,
that's a good point.
It always takes me back. It always strikes me oddly to realise how close different periods of history are together. They're not like separate houses.
Yeah.
They're rooms along the corridor.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she grew up through the Second World War with her academic anthropologist father and her academically inclined writer mother. And then she was writing when she was 38, by which point she'd married. if I remember correctly, she actually gave up her PhD.
That's what makes me think, when you say, you know, it's very important to her that she was described as an American author rather than American sci-fi, I get feminism from that. I get the sense that this is a woman who in the 50s married a man, and as a result of being married to a professional man, was sort of expected to give up her own profession.
And Le Guin isn't her family name, is it?
Is it not?
No, it's her husband, the man of the family. her husband, I think, Charles Le Guin, was a historian. And her parents were Kroeber.
And it's a beautiful name.
And it's a beautiful name, but she took her married name and made it her own. And it was her, you know, nom de plume.
But, you know, so as you always say, people never do anything for one reason. Yeah. So I'm sure there are multiple reasons, but I get a sense that she was sort of determined to push against some of the expectations of her time and succeed because of her own massive talent, not because of, you know, she took it. For example, you know, George Eliot famously... The tradition of pretending to be a man to get your book sold, otherwise everyone would be like, ooh, my woman has probably got blood all over it. So
another really silly example.
I really admire her,
and I think I think everybody you've spoken about in these last few podcasts, apart from Susanna Clarke, may she live 100 years.
We love you, Susanna. If we can't remember your name.
Is dead. Le Guin, I feel, is particularly a loss. But what I was going to say, here's the silliest sort of joining up around the back ever. Le Guin went to a place called Radcliffe College in Harvard. And Radcliffe College was established, I think, rather like sort of St. Hilda's or Lady Margaret.
It's the women's only one, right?
It's the women's only one.
Yeah.
And it was established under the regime of a Harvard president from the sort of Boston Brahmins class, who was, it's a term, it's a thing.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
To be clear, not Indian Americans, but upper class educators, literati in Boston were called collectively the Boston Brahmins. Anyway, this guy was called Charles Eliot of the Boston Eliots. So.
Of TS.
Of TS. So it all joins up around the back. Anyway, she's 38. She's writing it apparently with children in the house, which I hadn't really ever thought of.
That's interesting.
But yeah, so while she's at her typewriter,
yeah,
pounding out the confrontation with the dragon on Pendle, I don't know if it's 5-year-olds or 10-year-olds running up and down the stairs shouting. And so that's one thing is the age. But you said it's a book for children. Now, my kid is currently reading... She's 14. She's
I said it
reading,
wasn't a book for children. I said it was written for children, but I'm everyone couldn't appreciate it.
Absolutely right, yes. So that's the thing. So it was written... but it was commissioned as a book for children by her publisher, who said, you know, it's all very well.
Well, if I remember correctly, it's just to be specific about it, because I think it's relevant, she had written books for children before, and I understand that her publisher said to her, based on the successes of her children's book, why don't you write a book for slightly older children, so teenagers, and more importantly, he said, because of the successes of her previous work, you have no boundaries. Do whatever you think would work for this
range
of readers. Which is how I think we got such a sort of absolutely earth-shattering book from her, because there wasn't anybody saying, and could you put in this bit and maybe this theme would be appropriate. They just said, you're obviously a good writer. You've got experience with younger kids. Do something older that is more relevant for teenagers. And off you go.
So that's what I'd forgotten, the sort of do whatever you like thing, which is relevant. So my kid, I was saying, who's 14, is reading Rick Riordan, the Percy Jackson books, which what I've seen of them are good. You know, they're written for kids and teens, and they're intentionally sort of accessible young adult. They're very plotty. But here is how Wizard of Earthsea begins. So it starts actually with that five-line piece of free verse right at the beginning, and then it... the first chapter begins. The Islands of Gond, a single mountain that lifts its peak mile above the storm-racked northeast sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports in its dark narrow bays, and it goes on a bit about Gond, and it says, of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both Dragon Lord and Archmage. His life is told in the deed of Gedney in many songs, .. So...
And it just gives me tingles.
So it's... It's not written for a kid, is it? You know, but I read it when I was seven, and I understood it, or I was intimidated by it. But straight away, there's sort of magisterial thing going on that says, you know, so there we go, some lovely setting design there. We say his he's told him the deed of Ged. So apparently he's famous enough, there's a poem about him, and it's called The Deed Of, which is obviously a sort of convention for the way things are talked about, and in many songs, which again tells us this is an oral culture and that things happened quite a long ago. And it subtly establishes the sense of texture and reality in the same way that when Susanna Clarke writes about Alessandri in and she has a fictional academic saying this is one of the versions of his autobiography, there's that immediate sneaky sense of patina that makes you believe it.
I think also,
but I was going to say that one more thing is it strikes me this is what Steven Pinker calls classic style, of which there are two characteristics. One, you're talking to the writer, to the reader as an equal, in the way you might be talking to them in person. So you're clear and articulate, but you're informal. You're not talking down to them or using jargon, and it follows a sort of conversational thread, which that does. And secondly, you use lots of clear concepts and imagery. So we begin with the sight of the Isle of Gond lifting its head from the sea as a mountain. So it's really good, but it's not written for children. It's not like you'd see a lot of YA stuff or pre-YA stuff these days. Doesn't begin like that.
No, but you can tell, as you say, that it is written with children in mind. So one of the things I like about the opening is, and this is me being a massive E-type here, if you can believe that, is...
Do you want to explain what that means?
I will afterwards. Okay. It tells the reader, presumably a teenager, that Ged is important because he becomes an archmage and he becomes a dragon lord. So immediately you're interested in them. Then, you know, tell me more about this amazing person who's achieved lots. And it also tells you he lives, which as a kid in a story about peril, I certainly really like knowing that the character's going to be okay. And what's interesting is, of course, she then goes on to quite, I think, powerfully subvert the idea that the hero is always all right. You know, last night, as a little segue, we were watching, for the first time in about 20 years, Beverly Hills Cop. You're welcome, you see. Podcast. You see, there we go. We're tap dancing. You just can't hear it. We're doing it in slippers. And I love Eddie Murphy, he's fantastic, but one of the things that I've forgotten was that apparently the character that he plays can just get like beaten up like quite savagely and he's totally fine within seconds. Like there's at one point the climax of the film, and spoilers, but it's like 1,000 years old, so you have no excuse. Like, he's being actually held by a gang of men and like beaten up for a good like 10 to 15 minutes. Now most people will be unconscious by that stage, I think. And like as soon as he's freed, he's out there, he's jumping down like staircases and shooting people with a crack shot. Like, he has no issues with it. Whereas I think Wizard of Oz was the first story I ever read as a younger person where the main character has lasting scars because, of course, Ged is facially scarred from his first interaction with the shadow. And it's quite a dark plot. You know, the whole thing is him having made this horrible mistake which killed somebody, and it didn't even kill the person that was directly involved. It killed basically an innocent bystander.
It did
because when he...
Oh, you did, you're right, sorry, of course. Yeah.
So for people who haven't read it, a little spoiler, okay, quite a big spoiler, so 3, 2, 1 spoiler time. One of the inciting incidences early on in the book is Ged is basically provoked into a duel, a magical duel, because he's a very precocious magician. He's obviously got a lot of latent talent and he knows it, so he's a bit smug and annoying. And an older student at the wizard school he is at, called Jasper, I believe, they have a rivalry and ultimately it ends in this duel. And because Ged is very powerful, but he's obviously not totally in control of it yet, he accidentally summons up a shadow of very frightening proportions. That is so frightening, it seriously damages Ged and gives him a lifelong scar on his face. Jasper, I think, runs away, and the archmage who runs the school is the one who has to come in and banish it or do something to it. I can't remember what he does.
He has to banish it, he has to drag Ged's spirit back to his body.
That's which is, it. Yeah. And this immense amount of magic, because Ged has accidentally summoned such a powerful creature, kills the archmage. So I find that even sadder than if it had killed Jasper, because at least Jasper would have been involved. It was just some nice old man who was really wise who had to come in and save a kid. And Ged has to carry that guilt for the rest of his life. And that is explicitly, you know, discussed. He obviously feels very bad, and it's a big turning point in his life because he realises that his sort of hubristic pride actually has consequences. And the rest of the book is Ged trying to address the issue of this shadow, which pursues him relentlessly throughout his life. And I won't spoil the total end of the book, but
there's the word you use there is consequences, and it hadn't occurred to me till you started saying this, how many times in the book Ged gets his shit fucked up. So he, at the beginning...
That was on the back of the book, the first edition.
He performs a feat of magic, which leaves
at
him...
At the start.
Yeah, which he's beyond his powers, that leaves him sort of in a semi-coma, speechless, yeah. And he has to be brought back by a mage.
But you remember there's a little foreshadowing before that as
I
well.
I do. Well, come back to that. Okay. But then he gets the... I mean, not this feat. I mean, at the beginning, like chapter one, his power comes to attention.
Yeah,
off,
when he's trying to show off to a girl, which is hilarious.
So what I'm thinking of is at the very, very beginning where he sends warriors away from the village by weaving a mist.
Oh, right, sorry.
And then he's in a sort of coma. And then he's in a very, very peril at various points, but he's in this kind of coma. He ends up in this kind of coma after he summons the shadow as well. Mm-hmm. He ends up trying to bring a child's fevered spirit back to his body and ending up in a coma again,
yeah.
For which he has to be brought back by his pet licking his hands.
Don't talk to me about the pet. I can't deal with the pet. If anyone is really attached to animals, beware this book.
And then he ends up going to a strange dark place.
Hogue. That was the pet's
Hogue.
Name. Hogue.
And strange dark place and confronting his shadow.
Mm.
And again, he gets his shit fucked up and wakes up in a sick bed being healed. And then later he gets trapped in the shape of an animal and he has to be brought back by a mage. So it's all about the scars and he's really vulnerable in the sense of vulnerability. I think you're right. I think the idea that he actually lived through it is a comfort when you're a kid and you're reading this. And the other thing, the word you use is consequence, because one of the key things in Le Guinian magic, and one of the things that makes it feel weighty and effective,
mm.
is there's always a sense of consequence. There's this capital E word, equilibrium, that the wizards have to
maintain. The balance is really important.
And that, you know, if you do something big, there's going to be an outcome, and maybe the outcome won't be great for you.
Mm.
And that allows it to feel... convincing and relevant in a way that not all magic does, because obviously, you know, a lot of magic is superpowers.
Mm.
Anthropology.
She had a background in anthropology, did she?
So her father was Kreb, I think, is this extremely eminent anthropologist who did stuff mostly on Indigenous and American...
I knew that Native American was an influence. I hadn't realised it was her father...
But obviously, anthropology is a lot of it's, you know, comparative. So you look at stuff from all over. So I think you can definitely see. I mean, a lot of it is just her reading, but you can definitely see the British folklore in Earthsea as well. I think you can see stuff that looks like Polynesian or even Indonesian culture in the archipelago and its.
Well, I know that Norse was also in it, big influence,
and Norse
with the cogs.
Well. So, well, shall we get the racial thing out of the way?
So one of the things...
That sounds, if you don't know, it's much less sinister than it sounds.
Don't worry. One of the things that Wizard of Earthsea was praised for was subverting the sort of classic idea that if you're a Western person writing an epic where there is a hero of some kind, almost always the hero is white. And sort of very casually, I don't know, like sort of 30 pages into the book, it is mentioned that Ged and his tribe... And his tribe's people are dark-skinned, and most of the characters we meet throughout the rest of the book are dark-skinned, I think. But Le Guin doesn't really lean into much character description. She doesn't sort of give you a really detailed description of how everyone exactly looks, which is why a lot of readers are sort of mildly taken aback when it's mentioned that Ged has dark skin, just because a lot of them were little European kids.
So we get the Kargs, the savage Viking raiders who come in and
who are explicitly pale-skinned, yeah.
But it was, I remember when I was reading, it was a real shock to me, because I grew up in, you know, at this point, it would have been 1979.
Mm.
I was living in southeast England, going to a school where there was usually sort of one black kid in each class.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'd seen people who weren't white, but I just sort of thought of the world as default white.
Mm.
And I got to about page 110, and it casually mentions that sort of... Ged's friend, he's not the sort of red-brown Ged is, so sort of Indigenous American coloured.
Mm.
He's like the dark brown in the southern reaches.
Vetch.
And I suddenly, Vetch, yeah, lovely character.
Love
Vetch. And I suddenly realised that, you know, all the sympathetic characters we've been talking about have been dark skinned. Mm. There was a real sort of moment where the world goes still and you realise that the world isn't always...
About you
and about the people next to you.
But
and
I like
of course
it because
these
it doesn't become a sort of... ethnic morality tale, which is exactly really nice. These, it's just like, this is just the way it is.
These days, it would be a capital I identity thing.
Let's move on.
So make a point, and De Guin probably actually gets stick for writing a story and appropriating other people's voice or whatever. But it was great. However, at the time, the book I read had a picture of Ged, Jasper and Vetch all on the front cover. And they're all, you know, the colour of Taylor Swift.
Well, I was going to say this caused controversy because, of course, and this is, I think, not a racist thing in and of itself, but often what sells stuff is people that look like the person they want to, that the publisher wants to buy the thing, right? So a lot of publishers wanted to put white characters on the front cover of the book to represent the fun stuff that went on inside because they were selling to primarily white consumers. And I think a lot of the publishers probably just hadn't read the book, so just assumed it was a white character and weren't making any
decisions. Le Guin got in a fight with the cover design.
But that's it. Obviously, she was angry because, like, that's just, like, wrong. So, yeah, we got that out of the way now. We're done with
that. We did. But I think the key thing is that at the time it was quite a bold thing to do, especially in a children's book. And she just did it. It's not a big deal. And then she got on with the rest
that's
of
what
it.
I think that's such a representative sort of moment. Like, that's the mood. It's sort of unusual, brilliant things happen. But they're just sort of casually discussed in the way that you casually discuss, like, oh, I went and got some bread yesterday, except replaced bread with a wizard. But and that's what makes the world, I think, so believable, that everything is presented as though it's normal, which allows you to just experience it like the character in the book for whom it is normal, you know.
Yeah, we went to a pool.
No, I thought you were going to say something.
Oh, no, I wasn't. No, I
he's picked up his phone in a meaningful way, which normally means he's about to check a quote and then present it to you as though he's just remembered it.
You've given away my secret. No, I thought there was something great I was going to say. I couldn't remember what it was. Oh, that was it. One of the other things that I've seen said about Ursie that I think people get slightly wrong is that there is no religion in it, which is very unusual for a pre-industrial society. I cannot think of one pre-industrial society in history, and very few in fantasy that don't have some sort of religion, whether it's with gods or not, and Ursie doesn't. They do have a creator figure, Segoi, who is said to have raised the Arse of the Deep, but that's about as much we know about him. But I think it's really that the wizards are the priests, because they have a priestly function in the communities they serve. They name people, they bless things, they serve as effectively spiritual leaders of the community, although that term's never used. And they interpret the myths, and they tell people the stories, and they remember the songs. And one of the things that struck me when I reread Ursie before this podcast was how the school of wizards in Roke is it's not like Potter. I'm not saying that in a sneery way. The Hogwarts is intentionally reminiscent, and you know, overwhelmingly reminiscent of Portia boarding schools in the 50s. That's the fantasy, is that you get plucked out of your mundane life.
And your Pebblesash house, and you're given a cloak.
Exactly. And the School of Wizards in Roke is monastic. Mm. They sleep in, I don't think they're actually called cells, but they're plain stone rooms. Mm. There are no women there.
Yes.
Women aren't allowed to become
wizards. But that's
interesting,
isn't
back it? It is interesting. And, there are... there's this really monastic feel to the institution. Mm. And
it's because the whole thing comes back to this equilibrium that you've talked about, that and the sense you get is that the world is very calm, except obviously, you know, the calamities happen, you know, it will thunder and be frightening and cargs will come and raid your village, but all the people in the book who are presented as aspirational or older and sort of authority figures, they all have this immense sense of, like, you know, be very careful, very much think before you act. It's very contemplative. The entire magic system is based upon naming things and working within the laws of nature and essentially communicating with the existing magical nature that permeates the world and controlling it in that way, rather than sort of saying special words that make something out of nothing. So it makes sense that the school teaching talented wizards to be would have this sort of calm monastic mood as well, because you are sort of essentially learning self-control before you can then learn natural magical control. And that, this of course is Ged's big evolution that, that he actually, as a lot of kids are, is very impulsive and ambitious, and he knows that he's a good magician. He's clearly got lots of talent, so he kind of wants to act now and doesn't really realise how powerful and important it is to be measured and thoughtful and work within, you know, the natural warp and weft of the world, which of course he ultimately does.
And there's this great moment at the beginning when he's sort of picked out by the wizard Ogion for his power, and he goes off to go be Ogion's apprentice. And Ogion is very zen. I mean, always sort of explicitly Quranic, a lot of the things
he sort of lives apart from society in a little hut, and he's very, very much like, think before you act.
And he
is so bored.
Yeah, so he goes off like to walk back to Ogion's place with Ogion. He's like, right, now I'm going to turn myself into birds, right?
Yeah.
Fly across the like, no, the path is this way. And I guess, like, when am I going to learn something? And he says something like, well, when you understand what I'm teaching.
Yeah.
And
I would find him infuriating.
That's the thing. He's presented very effectively. He's clearly a wise and patient dude.
And they, he loves him. He's very much a father figure.
Yeah.
He's not just a sort of wise old sage. He's like actually a very sort of down to earth. And it's all about, you know, have you made the soup today, Ged? And Ged's like, no, I want to learn how to like reverse death. And he's like, yeah, okay, but we need onions for the soup. So like, is that available?
There's this.
And Ged is very affectionate about him. He comes back to him later in the
novel. He does, and I think a lot of there's a sense of the paternal in the book that we keep coming back to.
Is Ged's father mentioned ever?
He is. He's a smith, and he has almost nothing in common with Ged. He's this sort of dour, practical man who's good with his hands.
Right.
And Ged never, as far as Ged thinks of him again once he's
yes,
left home.
Yes, yeah.
But the other thing I was going to say about the monastic, of course, is that when I think about monastic communities, because I'm a Brit who grew up in the Church of England, I think about Christian monastic communities, but obviously those aren't the only monastic communities in the world, and obviously Zen Buddhism also has monks, and obviously there are Taoist monks, aren't there?
There are Taoist priests.
I assume there are Taoist monastics.
It would fit.
And so again, you can see some of this flavour filtering through into Rome. And one of the things that I realised rereading it as an adult, looking for points for a podcast rather than just as a kid just enjoying the texture, is how many influences there are in Le Guin's magic. So there's obviously Taoist stuff, and there's lots of stuff about balance. There's sort of magia naturalis, Renaissance magic stuff around naming, around the connections between
things. I love the naming thing.
Around correspondences, and around explicitly, this was the big distinction, as I understand it, in a lot of Renaissance magic, is natural magic was magic that relied on things in the world that you called on and used the connections to, rather than summoning up spirits and asking their help or using their powers. There's very little of that.
Going back to the previous podcast we've talked about, a good example of those two versions would be Faustus, of course, who calls up spirits to do his work for him, and that obviously is sort of bad magic, versus someone like Prospero, who is using the spirits of the Isle to do things like make storms.
So this is the thing, you've got Goetia, you've got demonic magic, which is the Faustus thing, and then you've got Prospero, who's being much more responsible, and as you said, isn't dealing with demons, he is using Thergy to encourage spirits to do appropriate things, and he's not going too far beyond the boundaries. But natural magic is, in theory, 100% fire with the Church. I mean, it wasn't, of course, because all it really is another sort of variety of science where you're dealing with the natural world. I don't know how much that was what people actually believed, and how much was what they told the Jesuits. So there's natural magic, there's Taoism, there's Norse influence in lots of stuff, particularly in the naming things, which we will come back to. And things like the lists of names Ged has to learn remind me of the long mnemonic sections you get in the Eddas, and possibly in Old English poetry, so I don't
know. It's all about names. Well, it's particularly about ancestry. So it's Beowulf, son of Ecgtheow, son of Erenthil, which is why in Tolkien it's Aragorn, son of Arathorn, etc., etc., because your bloodline is incredibly important. But the name thing is also in Christian stuff. I mean, there's a whole thing of Adam naming everything in the world, which is massively important.
There is. I mean, absolutely. So there's lots more with the names, and that's not unique to Norse. But I mean, particularly one of the things that mages have to do is learn long lists of names.
Yes.
So it provides this gritty underpinning to it.
Yes.
And there's wonderful throwaway inventions that Ged has to spend like a season at the Isolate Tower at the south end of Rogue, where the master namer, who's called Curran Carmarook, which we're told is a name that has no meaning in any language, he just sits there and he makes people learn lists of names. And they're all written in ink that disappears at midnight. So if you don't learn it before then,
I remember that. Screaming. So good.
And if anybody complains about the list of the names, then Kummer and Comrade won't say anything. It was quietly lengthening. And I think Broca's Monastic, I also wonder about to what degree it is a reminiscence about her university days. But she spent time in 3 or 4 different academic institutions and she grew up in an academic household. Mm. And when you get all these mad lads at the summer festival in Roke, all sort of doing games of hide and seek with visibility spells or balls of whirlite for light shows, I wonder how much you think of sort of Harvard students getting drunk and putting whatever the Harvard equivalent of traffic cones is on the university statue.
Mm.
And the shamanism as well. He leaves his body, he goes to the land of the dead, which wasn't something Tolkienian.
No, not at all.
It just wasn't the kind of thing that came up. And there's this real sort of folkloric sense.
We haven't talked about whole dragons as well.
Yeah. And the dragons also are interesting because there's things from east and west. And east and western dragons are very different, but they're quite united.
You mean not within the fiction, you mean within our world?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I said that really confusing.
Just because, obviously, in the book, he goes very far west, which us cartographers refer to as the left, where he has this big, important climactic interaction with this very frightening dragon. And dragons are presented very, very frighteningly. They're like, they definitely exist, but they are not sort of, oh, look at that little dragon over there, he might grow into a big one day and we should look up, like, out for him. Like, it's like, do not mess with the dragon, right? They are bad, scary, old, clever, cunning, powerful things. And then you very much go to the east for the actual ending of the book, where he has this second climactic interaction with the shadow. So I was just confused. But you're talking about Western real-world ideas of dragons and Eastern real-world, right?
So, in the West, they are worms with or without a Y.
If you're cool, they have a Y. And that's how you can tell.
In the East, dragons are important in iconography and religion, and they tend to be associated, I think, often with the sky and with water. And in the West, they tend to be associated often with earth and with fire. Well, that's obviously.
Can I say the fun dragon bit about Beowulf?
Yeah.
That in the Cotton Vitalis AXV manuscript, in which Beowulf is forever enshrined. There is a section which is a sort of like, there's lots of like little stories that sort of finagle away from the actual Beowulf plot, and one of them is about this great worm with a Y, and unfortunately that bit of the manuscript has actually been eaten away by worms in real life, so we don't actually have the story of the worm because it was destroyed by a worm.
But conspiracy.
Maybe it was like a tiny proto dragon being like, "You shall not take my father's name in vain."
It was a tiny proto dragon being like, this is the bit where the dragon turns out to be a real dweeb.
it must get rid of it to show that dragons are
but
cool.
But you want to talk about names, and the dragons are a good way into that, because one of the things that makes dragons so frightening is they speak the old tongue.
So if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about with the names, the key underpinning of the magic system in Le Guin is that in order to control something, you must know its true name. So when we've been using words like Ogion, that I don't think is his true name. Everybody has sort of basically two names, one of which is their true name, which is almost universally kept private because it is such a powerful thing for someone else to know your name. And the other name is the one that you use every day for common speech. So, the equivalent is, I'm technically Charlotte, but everyone calls me Lottie, right? And obviously you could probably work out that I'm Charlotte if you know that my name is Lottie. But in Le Guin's system, if you called me Charlotte, then you'd have power. But if you called me Lottie, it's just like saying, hey, person over there. And the dragons, of course, know the true names in a way that humans have to learn the names, and they have to pass down the true names. It's not sort of obvious to humans, whereas dragons seem to have this intuitive understanding. And this leads to the confrontation with Yavord, this very frightening dragon of the West that Ged eventually fights. To him offering, because the big problem with Ged's shadow is he doesn't know the shadow's name, and he's been told by various very talented wizards either that it has no name, it's a totally nameless thing, which would be very, very unusual, or that it has a name, he just doesn't know it, or something else. And he defeats this dragon, and in return the dragon offers to tell Ged the shadow's true name, which would allow him then to control it and ultimately banish it and exorcise it. And importantly, he chooses something else. which I won't spoil.
So yeah, and that's again one of the moments that feels very different from, very unexpected, is he goes off this confrontation with the dragon and its eight wormlings, and he has bet his life on having guessed correctly that this is the same dragon that a certain hero of myth forced, and he came across its name on like a scroll in the Library of Rome.
Which shows you how important all the scholarship is, because if he hadn't done all of that work in the tedious Tower of Boringness, then he might never have had the knowledge to piece together potentially what this dragon is and control him.
Who knew an anthropologist's daughter married to a historian who's a scholar in her own right would have a high opinion of the value of research?
Conspiracy.
So the true speech, so names, so dragons. Oh, yeah, that was it I was going to say. One of the things we are told about the true speech is that humans can't lie in it because it's the fundamental language of the world.
I've forgotten that.
But dragons can because it's their native tongue.
Sneaky,
so they can't tell a direct
dragons.
Lie, they can twist it round.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it, but she wrote a book called City of Illusions, I think the year before she wrote Earthsea, although I'm not sure, where there is an alarming culture that may or may not be human that's taken over Earth, called the Xing, who are unusual in that they're the only culture who can lie telepathically.
What?
Everyone else has used telepathy. Though.
What a horrible idea.
So this is obviously something that was of interest to her, which she comes back to.
Yeah.
But the dragon confrontation, so again, no spoilers.
I have given them quite a lot of spoilers.
I know, but you never know. Somebody might be reading, or somebody might be half remember it, and Ged confronts the dragon of Pendor, who's this terrifying old thing that's laired in the isle he despoiled.
He's very scary.
And he's got these eight dragonlings which he's been watching grow, which are very dangerous. They're sort of size of a longship or something, and some of them breathe fire. But the dragon of Pendor is literally the size of a castle. Ged originally thinks he is a castle when he first sees him. And Ged fights the dragons and kills five or six of them before he rouses Pendor to come out. So this is again a sort of very mythic structure where he sort of calls them out to battle, fights them, and then the other foe comes out. This is the first time we actually see any sort of magical combat. And I don't know how conscious this was. I don't know how Le Guin was just doing what was interesting and how much he was thinking about consistency and sustainability. But one of the problems with magical duels is they tend to default to people throwing fireballs or lightning at each other.
Yeah.
Not always, and you know, there are other sort of well-established tropes. There's the shape-shifting contests, for example, which are always fun.
Merlin.
When people think about things you do with magic, the sort of fireballs are really a shorthand for the least interesting sort of magical combat thing you can do.
Yeah, basically, I've made a magical gun.
And what you've got, if you've got a magical gun, the other person's got a magical gun, and you're effectively doing something like a firefight where you're hiding behind cover and zapping each other.
Which isn't very interesting.
I mean, it can make for a good action scene, but then you can't go beyond it. And if somebody turns into a wolf, you're like, well, I'll zap you, and then you're a wolf on fire. So again and again, whenever...
that was the first draft, actually.
Whenever Ged gets into trouble and tries to get out of it using magic, he'll do an oblique thing which somebody else will respond to obliquely. So, for example, the first dragon that comes out to fight him, he casts a binding spell on it just to bind its wings to the side of its body, and it's over the sea, so it just falls in the sea.
Mm.
And the second, he does it again. And the third, there's a sort of pause, and three dragons come out, and they're like, right, we've got you now. And they deliberately come at him from the north and the south so that he... can't hit them with a binding spell, as we're told, you know, binding spells can't work in two directions simultaneously. And he's only got a moment, so he actually changes himself into a dragon and goes and fights them. So it's this sort of back and forth call and response thing that allows for a bit more. And again, there's a point later in the book where a character who Ged is temporarily allied with is stopped by guards. And she shouts something in the old speech, and they fall to the ground, writhing. And he says, what did you do? And she said, oh, I ran molten lead in the marrow of their bones. They will die of it.
Mm.
And you're like, oh, but this could do that, can they? So one of the problems with magic, of course, is once you've established people can do something, then you have to wonder why they don't do something in some context.
Which is again where the equilibrium comes in.
Where the equilibrium comes in. So lots of books spend a lot of time sort of taking powers away or saying, you know, that we're being watched by Sauron, so we can't muck about.
Yeah.
But this is where the equilibrium thing comes in. This is wonderful because a lot of villains or renegades can use magic carelessly, so they're a real threat. And then our protagonist and his associates are less willing to use magic because we're told there could be consequences. You know, calm on the Reach can be calm in Rogue can be storm in the Reach and drought in Osgill, I think is what they say at one point. Unless you know what you're about, so it provides a rationale. Very difficult, very interesting, but very difficult to do in a game, except in the most sort of, you know, straightforward way. You get like a chaos meter rising or something. I've seen things like that. But very effective in a literary context.
And of course works with the theme of the book, because you're right that, you know, from a structural point of view, Le Guin needs a reason as to why magicians aren't constantly exploding everything all the time, if they can. And of course the big plot is Ged reeling and coping and coming to terms with this massive mistake he made early on in his life, which was about him essentially opening Pandora's box. So he is very loath, understandably, to do it again. And part of his growing up and part of his mastery of magic is recognizing not only when he should delve into the magic that he knows how to use, but what magic he should choose. Because again, if Ged at a very young age had fought dragons and presumably had the power to fight them, just assume that, he probably would have done something insane, like again summon the shadow accidentally or something. Whereas a binding spell is not the first thing you think of if you say you have to go and fight a dragon. You would think, what is my biggest spell and how can I make it bigger? So it's, you know, it all works thematically.
There's another very effective point made early, which is the difference between illusion and truth. So mages can do lots of things with seeming, and they can appear to change their shape, or they can appear, or they can summon light, or they can provide a banquet of food that will feel like it has substance but doesn't nourish you. But it's much harder actually to change the world. It's possible, but it's difficult. And what that means is then for the rest of the book, whenever a magician appears to do something, we always have this get-out clause of maybe some of it was illusion. There's one point at which I think, you know, Ged is actually in the boat that he sort of keeps afloat with spellcraft.
I remember that.
But he also just like puts an illusion over it because he's so, although
he's stressed
magic
by it.
Up, yeah, he doesn't like the water in the bottom of the boat.
That's so lovely. What a nice detail.
And this again sort of suggests that if we think, well, hang on, how come we could do that at the moment? And everyone's unreliable. So when somebody says, I ran molten lead to the marrow of their bones, they will die of it. Maybe she's just bragging. People spend a lot of time bragging.
Yeah, that is true. And that's one of the lovely things, well, one of the many lovely things about the novel, that it does meld, I think, possibly better than any other novel I've read, magic and the human. So one of my favourite things about the book is the true name thing. Brilliant idea. Makes a lot of sense to the magic. Really interesting. But from a human perspective, one of the things you can do to prove your loyalty and love for somebody is to tell them your true name, is to entrust the most powerful thing you can give to somebody with a third party who can then use it against you if they want to. But of course you trust them enough so you don't. So we mentioned Vetch earlier, who is Ged's best friend essentially, that he meets at school and is a sort of recurring force for good in Ged's life throughout the rest of the book. And they do exchange true names, which is really powerful because it's actually using this the same motif that ultimately overpowers Yavord, the Dragon of the West. But it's also a sort of proof of loyalty between two schoolboys, and it's exactly the same system, and that's totally beautiful.
And Vetch, I remember, is just this really benign presence, because he's
a bit older, isn't he?
He's a bit older, but he treats Ged as a peer from the beginning.
Because everyone's impressed by Ged's ability, and most people are kind of annoyed by it, because I mean, I'm sure everyone listening to this can remember the precocious kid at school, and basically everyone's jealous. And maybe the kid's annoying, because they know they're great. But that's very much Ged's early years. He's not the most likeable of chaps, and Vetch clearly sees something in him that most people don't, and doesn't befriend him because he thinks he's cool and powerful. He befriends him because he thinks he's sort of lonely, and
crucially befriends him like on the first night when Ged's lying alone in the cell, so the young girl wanted to come here, and Vetch just turns up and tells him about his own life, and they become friends.
Basically how I met one of my best friends.
This was the lady who cave in and ate biscuits at you, isn't it?
Yeah, I was very nervous when I went to university, and I'm like not very good at meeting new people, so I was just sitting in my room doing whatever, and this girl who happened to be set up above me in the room above just came downstairs and literally just came, sat on my bed, ate my biscuits, which frankly I was a bit like, hang on, we don't even know each other's names and you're eating my stuff, and sort of didn't move for 4 hours. And then, you know, last year she was a bridesmaid at my wedding, so it's a good technique.
This is one of the things I eventually realised about the difference between extroverts and introverts, is that part of the reason extroverts get extrovertier and introverts get introvertier is that introverts don't get as much pleasure from being around other people. So when they are around other people, they think, oh, do the other people want to be around me?
Yeah, constantly.
Whereas extroverts think, oh, I'm around other people, that's great. They must also enjoy being around me.
That is so true. Right, anything else to say? Because you haven't really said why you like the magic system so much. I've talked about it, but what was it that attracted you to the Le Guinian magic?
So when I was... So it wasn't like anything I'd seen.
It's very unique.
It made sense.
Very
there
unique.
Was this constant... So yes, I know.
I'm sorry.
You're very distinctive. No, you're
that's
absolutely
That's what
right.
I meant.
It was very distinctive. I think I'd read Rings by that point. You know, Gandalf's interesting and talking is a lot of flavourful stuff. But it's not about... It's not a book about wizards. And every sort of fourth page with Le Guin, there's another revelation about the way magic works or the way things are that unfolds naturally as part of the plot, which if you are a sort of system-inclined person is very appealing. Part of it is how much I enjoyed it when I first read it, and part of it is how it stayed relevant in my life, because she drew so many inspirations from so many different sources that you I think if you read Ursi when you're young, or even when you're older, you then come across things that seem familiar because she's drawn so many threads together. Part of what we haven't talked about is just her prose is
beautiful.
So lucid. And I think I've said before, I think I said this about Clark, one of the marks of a really good lucid writer is that you can return to a book 10 years later and the sentence will look familiar on the page if it's stayed with you.
That's a really nice...
And that's pretty much every page of Le Guin is like that. There's a couple of really, really spooky bits in it. There's the scene that you mentioned earlier where young Ged is tempted by the, you know, women.
I think the female author was making a point there, listeners.
Yeah. He's tempted by the daughter of a witch to go and look up a spell for summoning the dead.
Yeah.
And she's like, I bet you couldn't summon the dead. He's like, I could if I wanted. And she's like, oh, okay, whatever. So he goes home, he takes the Book of Power off the shelf,
he reads Ogion's books, yeah,
and he starts reading it. He's puzzling out the runes, but he can't really understand it, but he's reading it. And then he realises to his horror that while he's been reading, the room is growing dark.
I remember this, it's really scary,
and a horror comes over him, it says. And he tries to lift his eyes from the page, but he can't. He has to keep reading the spell. Then he looks up, and in the darkness by the door, there's this clot of shadow, and he thinks it's reaching towards him and whispering, and he panics. And then, just then, Ogin comes in and does a whole...
I literally remember the phrase, clot of shadow.
Yeah. And again, that's beautiful, right? Because it suggests a whole bunch of stuff. It's vague.
It's horrible.
It implies blood. It implies gunk. I have a debt to acknowledge as well. That was the other thing I was going to say. The Percussigut in Cultist Simulator.
Is that inspired?
Directly inspired by the shape of the bad thing in Ged, in a wizard, when it comes through the hole in the air and first attacks him. It's a faceless thing like a bear. It's got limbs but no head. And that obviously
shoulder
marked
its
me as
way
a kid.
Through
yeah.
the...
Yeah, and obviously the Percussigut is nothing like the shadow in terms of its, you know, behavioural nature, but it looks very similar in the art direction I guess.
Okay, so we have
is...
got a Le Guin reference in Cultist.
Yes,
that
do.
Makes me feel better. She deserves it.
So I'm going to end on something. Adam Roberts, the author and academic, suggested about Le Guin and Tolkien. And I don't know if this is a coincidence or if it was intended.
Was it that if you invited both of them to your party and they came, you should be really happy?
I think so. You know, Robert Oppenheimer used to visit Le Guin's family's home.
What, like
because,
a stalker?
No, because they were like academics in Berkeley and he was sort of Institute of Advanced Sciences.
That's a weird connection.
And, allegedly, although I don't know if Le Guin actually said this, he was the... inspiration for the protagonist, who's a physicist in The Dispossessed, anarchist novel. Adam Roberts points out that we are told at one point in The Wizard of Ersea that the true name of the sea is Inien. That's the word that means sea in the old speech. And we're also told that the word for a rock is Tolk. So Earthsea arguably be Tolk Inien.
Oh my God, is that...
I think it might be a coincidence. I think, you know, we are told the word for a pebble or rock is Tolk.
What a lovely homage.
But I think it's a hell of a coincidence.
It is a hell of a coincidence. Well, that's such a nice note to end on.
There you go.
Which is also nice because I think this is probably going to be our last episode on magic in literature. And I don't know, there's just something really profound about Wizard of Ersea, and I think it deserves to be the final word on the matter.
I think a lot of people do their best work when they are past their first couple of novels or games and they have some experience and they know what they're doing, but before they bed in too late. And I think, arguably, Earthsea was a particular zenith in Le Guin's career, but she continued to sort of deepen and continue discourse with herself later. I want to go back and read the second Earthsea trilogy, because when I read it the first time, I sort of wanted more adventure books about magicians, and they're not that at all. And these days, I suspect I'll enjoy them more. But anyway, what should we talk about next time? Spiders? Trombones?
No, don't ruin the beauty of this ending. It's a very peaceful ending. It's the wave going out from the shore. So we will salute you, Ursula, and everyone else. Have a balanced day.
Spooky.